The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. I'm going to start with an article from AARP, the magazine. And this is under the heading of This is 70, Living with Purpose. The deep need to live a life of purpose. The Japanese have a word for it, but the instinct is alive among older Americans. This is by T.R. Reid. One of the great pleasures of learning a foreign language is the discovery of terms denoting things we don't have a word for in English. German has a host of them, like Schadenfreude, the shadow pleasure you feel at somebody else's failure, and Verschlimmbessern, making things worse when you were trying to make it better. When I lived in Japan, I came up on words like that all the time. Gems like Yugen, the profound sense that your existence is just a speck in the vast expanse of the universe. And then there's the Japanese word Ikigagari. It's written with two characters that stand for living and value. Ikigagari means making your life worthwhile, living in a way that provides pleasure for you and value to those around you. We don't have this word in English, but we have the concept. Americans generally share the desire to do something useful with their lives. When I was younger, I had no problems in the Ikigari department, but now I'm turning 80, and Ikigari has become a problem. I'm retired. Heck, I could sit around the house all day doing nothing but reading books, playing Wordle, and making umeboshi origami. Rice balls filled with pickled plums. Oh, that's umeboshi onigiri. A skill I picked up in Japan. Frankly, there are some days when that's all I do. And yet, the yearning to be useful remains strong. This seems to be a common impulse. Many retirees I know have that sense of purpose. My friend John, a retired Latin teacher, rendered into English an important tract from the medieval theologian Thomas A. Kempis. My college roommate Fred dug out his old double bass and started playing with community and university orchestras. My neighbor Daniel became a substitute teacher in the public schools. My pal Eileen volunteered as a guide at the art museum. Older people are more politically engaged than those younger fellows. Folks past Medicare age are more likely to contribute to and work on campaigns. Me too. I've campaigned, raised money, and written speeches for ballot proposals and candidates. Many of us have found Ikigari by volunteering for charities. I'm a board member, along with some other 70-somethings, at three local 501c3 organizations. I don't volunteer much for projects or committees anymore, but I do provide institutional memory that may keep the younger board members from committing acts of Verschlimmbessern. But I plan to continue the charitable and political work because you're never too old to pursue Ikigai. T.R. Reid is the author of 10 books in English and 3 in Japanese. Now, also from the magazine under the heading of Money Saver by Jean Chatsky, let's look at an article entitled A House Divided. Splitting an inheritance gets complicated. The problem. Married couple John and Tina Vanderjot wanted to know what's fair. Since 2005, the two, both 71, have lived in the Los Angeles home John's mother left to him and his sister, Lisa. Now, Lisa, 69, wants John and Tina to buy out her share. But the math isn't easy. John and Tina have been paying the mortgage, and they have spent money on improvements. How much is owed? Asked Tina. And more important, can they do this and not strain their relationship? The advice. A lot of families will likely face this issue. A 2023 Charles Schwab survey found that 76% of parents plan to leave their homes to their children. those children are better off setting a course of action upon inheriting the home rather than waiting, says John Barron, co-founder of Banyan Global Family Business Advisors in Boston. That could mean selling the home on the open market, having one sibling buy the others out, or defining terms of co-ownership. Otherwise, it can get messy, as in the Van der Yachts case. I spoke with several experts, estate planning lawyers, family business consultants, CPAs, and divorce financial planners, who specialize in splitting the proverbial pie. They made some important points. First, you need to acknowledge the parents' intent. For Lisa and John's mother, it was to divide assets equally. Second, the value of what Lisa and John inherited has changed. Appraised for $614,000 when their mother died, the house is now valued at $1.8 million, due in part to real estate appreciation and in part to improvements made by John, but not Lisa. And though John and Tina get the benefits of living there, they have also been paying the $250,000 mortgage taken out before his mother's death to finance a renovation. They've also covered taxes, insurance, and everyday maintenance. The question is, can we disentangle those things? Barron says. A consensus of sorts formed around the math suggested by Jody D'Agnostini, a divorce financial planner at the Falcon Financial Group in Morristown, New Jersey. Starting with the home's current value, she subtracted the $175,000 remaining on the loan, leaving $1.625 million as the value of the asset being split. Then she subtracted the cost of the improvements John and Tina had made, plus the principal and interest they had paid on the mortgage. Dividing the result by two, she got $667,500 as the amount the couple should pay Lisa. B.J. Hoffman, a CPA at Citrin Cooperman in Philadelphia, differed slightly, noting that he wouldn't back out John and Tina's total mortgage payments because half of them were their obligation anyway. By his calculation, Lisa is due $730,000. All agreed that there was no perfect answer. What you're trying to do is to get to a solution that feels approximately fair and doesn't cause tension in a relationship, says Barron. The goal, he adds, is to be able to say, I can live with that. The outcome? After I showed the family both sets of numbers, they split the difference. Lisa accepted John and Tina's offer of $700,000 for her share. They're still negotiating payment terms, but all agree that untying this 18-year-old knot has made them feel better. It's almost like we've been in therapy. We're dealing with our feelings with each other, said Tina. It's kind of a relief. Now, let's look at a health article here. It's in AARP, the Bulletin. The good stuff living inside you. Doctors are discovering how microbes in your gut can help fight disease, lower weight, and extend your life. You have no doubt heard a lot over the past several years about gut health. But what even is your gut? If you're thinking it's just the big soft area below your rib cage, you're only partly right. The vast majority of your microbiome, the 100 trillion bacteria, fungi, and other organisms essential to your health, is located in your large intestine. Up to 5 pounds of microbes play an enormous role in determining everything from your heart health to your brain health, from how much you weigh to how long you'll live, from how happy you are to how well you'll sleep tonight. Much of it is located in a very specific place known as the cecum, a small sac at the entryway to your large intestine, near your right hip bone. Consider it like Margaritaville of your microbiomes. It's where partially digested food gets blended with your body's bacteria before moving on. As we get older, the ecosystem within our gut gets older too. Decades of questionable food choices, a lack of exercise, and exposure to antibiotics and pesticides, which are, after all, designed to kill off microbes, can leave our microbiome weakened. Indeed, just by looking at the gut, researchers can tell whether a person is on a path to frailty. The gut is the master controller of inflammation in the body, weight gain, rising cholesterol levels, increased blood sugar. Issues we associate with getting older are in many ways indications of our microbiomes becoming less and less healthy. This is good news, actually, because if you know how to eat to protect your microbiome, you may be able to pump the brakes on these age-related issues and stay healthier and more robust for longer. All of which is relatively recent news to the medical community, including gastroenterologists, the very physicians who specialize in gut health. When I was first studying medicine at NYU in the 1990s, we were taught that the microbiome is responsible for just one main task, digestion, says Roshini Raj, MD, Associate Professor of Medicine at NYU Grossman School of Medicine and author of Gut Renovation. Today, we've learned that the microbiome is, in many ways, the epicenter of our physical and emotional health. Imagine your gut as like a tiny national park filled with thousands of diverse species that work together to maintain balance. About 85% of those species are beneficial to your health. If we don't properly feed and nurture our gut, that balance can get thrown off. The diverse network of species begins to decline, and a coterie of unhealthy bacteria, including E. coli and H. pylori, which causes ulcers, can start to take over. When that happens, chronic inflammation takes hold. If you think that sounds bad, well, you're right. Because by controlling inflammation, a healthy microbiome plays an enormous role in just about every bodily function. For example, when your gut is balanced and healthy, you are more likely to control your weight. In one study, researchers compared the microbiomes of 54 sets of twins. They found that the twin with the most variety in their microbiome was the one least likely to be overweight or obese. You can reduce your risk of Alzheimer's. Special studies have shown that the gut gets microbiomes of people with Alzheimer's are significantly different from those with healthy brains. In a report in the journal Nutrition Reviews, researchers state that improving the gut microbiome might represent an effective strategy for preventing or at least easing Alzheimer's disease. Boost your longevity. A 2023 study of 195 people 100 and older living in Japan and Sardinia found that the microbiomes of these centenarians were healthier and more diverse than those of younger adults. Another study looked at the microbiomes of 728 female twins ages 42 to 86. It found that the less diverse a woman's microbiome, the higher she scored on a frailty index. An unhealthy microbiome has been linked to an increased risk of atherosclerosis, diabetes, osteoporosis, muscle loss, and autoimmune disease, among other longevity killers. It would impact your happiness. A 2020 study of 655 subjects found that those who had the highest levels of stress and anxiety and the lowest levels of social support showed the lowest levels of diversity in their microbiomes. Other studies have found that our gut bacteria may play a role in our levels of self-esteem, our sociability, how well we sleep, our risk of alcoholism, and even how likely we are to fall in love. The vast majority of serotonin, the hormone that antidepressants are designed to boost, is generated by the microbes in our gut, and the microbiome communicates with the brain to stimulate the production of oxytocin, the feel-good hormone that's released when we're connecting with the people we love. That's more than enough reasons to make gut health a priority. So, how are we doing? really, really bad. How to help them help you. Here's the thing about these 100 trillion buggers in your belly. They get hungry, and more we're simply failing to feed them well. When we eat whole foods, especially fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, seeds, and legumes, those foods pass through our digestive tract and down into our colon, where the microbiome chomps away at the natural fibers that come with these plant foods, and in return, creates a variety of anti-inflammatory compounds that help lower our risk of all those age-related problems cited above. Processed food that have been stripped of their fiber, think white rice, white flour, chips, fast food, and the vast majority of products that come in boxes and bags, are digested and absorbed quickly by the stomach and small intestine. They seldom even make the full journey down through the gut to the colon. A 2023 study found that when we eat a fiber-rich diet of whole foods, our microbiomes absorb more than 100 calories a day, and in some cases as much as 400 calories, that quite literally passed your lips but never made it to your hips. When we eat processed food, which makes up a whopping 60% of calories in the American diet, more of those calories go to us, not our microbiomes. And when we don't properly feed our microbiomes, they can't be as effective at protecting our health. A 2022 study in JAMA Neurology found that adults who consumed 20% of their calories from ultra-processed foods showed faster rates of cognitive and executive function decline compared with those who ate lower amounts. And when we don't properly feed our microbiomes, they can't be as effective as protecting our health. A 2022 study showed this. By contrast, another study published the same year found that those 60 and older who ate the most fiber-rich foods showed greater cognitive function than those who ate the least. It's not just the amount of fiber we eat, it's the variety. Research by the UC San Diego Center for Microbiome Innovation found that the greater variety of plants your diet holds, the healthier your microbiome. Those with the healthiest microbiomes were people who ate at least 30 different types of plants, vegetables, whole grains, fruits, nuts, seeds, and legumes a week. Diversity drives diversity. If you only eat one type of fiber, you're only going to feed one type of microbiome, says Marla Gloria Dominguez-Bello, a microbiologist at Rutgers University. She and her partner, Martin Blester, MD, also a microbiologist, strive to eat at least 20 different plants every single day. Very few of us can achieve anything like that level of diversity in our diets. By some estimates, 30% of the vegetables eaten by Americans are white potatoes. But it is surprisingly fast and easy to spark change in the microbiome. In one experiment, Tim Spector, MD, a genetic epidemiology professor at King's College in London, enlisted his son Tom to spend 10 days eating nothing but fast food. Tom took fecal samples before, during, and after the 10-day period. Laboratory analysis reveals that more than 1,300 specific species of microbes had been essentially wiped out in just over a week. Just as we can tear down our microbiomes quickly, we can rebuild them rapidly. One study looked at people who ran a half marathon and found that their microbiomes changed for the better over the course of a single race. The first step in rebuilding a healthier microbiome is to set a simple and reachable goal. Over the course of the next 7 days, track how many different plants, whole grains, vegetables, nuts, fruits, seeds, and legumes you consume. If you eat the leaf, stem, grain, seed, fruit, or root of the plant, it counts. Processed foods such as fruit leather or white flour tortillas do not. Write them down. Make it a competition. Can you eat more different plants than your friends or family? You might find you pass 30 in just a couple of days, or you might find toward the end of the week that you've got to start getting a little creative. But simply tracking how many different plants you eat over the next 7 days can be an enormous first step. Simple steps like adding different fruits to your salad, eating the sides that come with your meal, or throwing some grilled veggies on your sandwich can help you get to your goal. Once you've learned to maximize the variety of plants you eat, you will have learned how to maximize the diversity of the microbes in your gut. And that will make them and you happier and healthier for life. Now, here's five easy ways to boost your belly biome. Think it's hard to eat 30 different plants in 1 week? Just do this. Power up your pasta or pizza. Marinara sauce is based on one plant, tomatoes. Add onions, peppers, sliced garlic, roasted broccoli, olives, or mushrooms. Mix up your greens. Instead of iceberg, romaine, or even kale, opt for the spring mix. You could quadruple the number of plants with this one simple swap. Turn that black bean soup into a 12-bean soup. Want a sandwich with that? Swap wheat bread for 12-grain bread with a variety of whole grains and seeds. Instead of a can of peanuts, buy a nut mix that includes almonds, pecans, pistachios, and more. And don't forget flax, pumpkin, hemp, chia, and sunflower seeds. And finally, if you love cereal for breakfast, try to top it with a different nut, fruit, and seed every day. For dessert, jazz up your ice cream with a variety of nuts and fruit toppings. And since we're on the subject of food, from AARP, the magazine, we have Foods for Stronger Bones. Everyone knows that consuming foods rich in calcium and vitamin D helps keep your bones strong. We asked Brenda Smith, a professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine, if there are other foods that can help people over 70 avoid osteoporosis. She offered these ideas to boost your bone health. A kale salad with blue cheese sprinkled in it. Vitamin K found in large, dark leafy greens such as collards and kale, and in fermented cheeses such as Gouda, Swiss, and blue cheese, is a key to bone strength. Research shows that it supports new bone formation and reduces the rate of bone breakdown. Sweet potatoes. Consider an alternative to the spud. The Bone Health and Osteoporosis Foundations recommends adding sweet potatoes to your weekly meal mix. Rich in magnesium, a mineral that helps lower the risk of osteoporosis, they promote healthy bones and cartilage. Dried plums. Research has found that prunes, aka dried plums, can prevent bone loss, and some preclinical studies have pointed to their potential to help rebuild bone density. And finally, tart cherry juice. The juice has to be from tart cherries, which are chemically similar to plums, not sweeter cherry varieties. The phenolic acids and saccharides found in both fruits work together to prevent bone loss. Now, we'll take a quick look at a money article. You earned it, spend it. Philip Rams was having lunch recently when he balked at ordering an iced tea that would bump his $15 tab up closer to $20. Then it hit him. I've got money. I can have iced tea. Rams, who prefers using his pseudonym, was raised in a working-class neighborhood in Queens, New York. As a grown-up, he worked at an investment firm, saved his money, started buying co-ops at bargain prices in Manhattan in the 80s, and eventually bought 2 6-story apartment buildings near Central Park. Today, he's a millionaire, but his working-class habit of saving every dime never left him. Many people over 70 still cling to lifelong patterns of parsimony, says counseling psychologist Nancy Schlossberg of Sarasota, Florida. Often they were raised by Depression-era parents who drilled saving into their brains, making it difficult for them to ever spend on themselves. The subliminal message from childhood took deep root. Don't indulge too much. Be careful with money. What if your investments plunge? Schlossberg isn't talking about those of us who see frugality as vital to safeguarding our long-term security. She's referring to financially secure people like Rams, for whom aggressive saving is more of an obsession. Such people, she notes, often derive a sense of security from having a big number on a sheet of paper representing their net worth, and don't want to see that number shrink, even with inevitable market ups and downs. Others have an irrational fear that if they start acquiring things, they won't be able to stop. Still, others have a deep feeling that they haven't earned the right to indulge themselves, she says. Of course, some have laudable goals, like saving for their grandchildren or someday making a meaningful charitable contribution to a museum or an orchestra. However, living a little can be good for your emotional health, Schlossberg says. The key is to know when that is appropriate and when being cautious with money makes sense. Patty Black, a financial partner at Savant Health Management in Birmingham, Alabama, says for people 70-plus, the 4% rule of thumb can offer a snapshot of what they can afford to spend on indulgences. Essentially, it says that if Social Security and other fixed income streams are covering your monthly costs, you can safely withdraw 4% of your retirement investments each year. For example, a couple with $500,000 in investments can spend $20,000 a year beyond the quality of life afforded by Social Security and other fixed income. Black says no one is guaranteed tomorrow. If there's something you want to do, like a cruise or a trip, come up with a plan to make that happen. Schlossberg urges those squeezing every buck to reframe their thoughts around balanced life. If you have a good handle on your financial resources, spend some money. Indulge yourself, she says. This article was by Gary Stern, and he has been published by the New York Times, Reuters, and others. Well, we have just a little bit of time left, so let's look at a few more items about your brain. Did you know, in the long run, lottery winners are no happier than anyone else? Did you know that charitable actions increase levels of happiness? Experiences make people happier than possessions. Some mice pass pheromones through the male's tears. Older people are more satisfied with their lives than younger people. Distress over heartbreak and physical pain activates the same brain regions. Psychologist Martin Seligman lists three components of happiness: pleasure, engagement, and meaning. And finally, men are more likely than women to express their depression as anger. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.